Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Ready, set, vote. Early voting in Charlotte's municipal elections began this morning. Statewide, 447 cities, towns, and villages, and in 88 counties are holding off-year elections. 67 have opted to only allow voting on Election Day in November, but that is not the case here. On the ballot in this election in Charlotte are races for school board, Charlotte City Council, the office of mayor, and the 1% sales tax for transit referendum. In fact, that's on the ballot throughout Mecklenburg County. In council races, many were decided in the primary. The most competitive race is that in District 6, which is an open seat, pitting Democrat Kimberly Owens against Republican Krista Bakari. But it is the outcome of the vote on the sales tax referendum that is the nail-biter. If voters say yes, over $19 billion will flow into transit and road projects for the next 30 years. If voters say no, there is no Plan B. So we spend the hour discussing that and a lot of other things, something even more important that we never used to have to consider: election integrity and the security and accuracy of the vote. We're joined by WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. He's here along with Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, and Michael Dickerson is director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. Good morning to you all. Thank you for being here.
Morning.
Good morning.
And Michael, I'm going to start with you because Mecklenburg County early voting began today. It runs through, I believe, November the 1st, but not
correct.
All of the early voting polling places are open today. Many will open later on in the process as we get close to Election Day. How many places are open this morning?
Today we have our good morning first, and today we have our Hal Marshall Annex open uptown. Eight to five today and tomorrow, eight to five next Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then next Thursday, a week from today, all 21 sites will be open from 8 a.m. till 7:30 at night.
So, if you live in Davidson, do you have to drive to the Hal Marshall Center to vote early today? Is that the deal?
Today you would. Today you would, yes. Or you could go online, request an absentee ballot by mail, and we can send that right out to you. You request a day. I have it in the mail to you by late this afternoon.
I would not know how to get there.
Okay. You've been involved, Michael, in elections here and at the federal level for about 25 years, and you say that in all that time, early voting is the biggest change. How so? Why? Yeah. Who is most likely to vote early and why?
Well, it's funny. We started this process in 2000, early voting. The first year we did early voting, Republicans outvoted Democrats. As a matter of fact, candidates at that time, I remember Congresswoman Sue Myrick had an ad that said, "You can vote for me early at South Park or at the South County Regional Library." Included that in her ad. Republicans beat Democrats in that first vote, early voting process. Now it's gotten to the point where everybody likes to vote early. Everybody has chosen to vote early. You still have a lot of people that still want to go on Election Day, but the last presidential election, over, I think it was 80% were voting before Election Day. Those are huge numbers, and those are extremely beneficial for us because we can get 17 days worth of voting done, and it doesn't put the stress on the process.
Speaking of numbers, how many people do you anticipate voting in this off-year election? It's usually pretty slim.
It is. It's not going to be the 70% we had last year. We're hoping for usually in these, you get 17, 18, 19%. My hope is we're up to 20 or 25% because you've got a lot of good candidates on this ballot. And you mentioned it in your prelude that there's the transportation sales tax that we have all already got mailers about. So that is something that might drive a lot of voters out.
Some people, Michael, may be new to this area. Some people may be unsure if they are actually registered to vote. And of course, there were those recent efforts to purge voting rolls of individuals who didn't, for whatever reason, accurately or completely fill out their information on file at the state level. So let's talk about that. First, if you're new to the area or if you have moved from one address in the area to another, is it too late to amend your voter registration or to register to vote in this election?
This will not yet. Not yet. I say not yet because you have these 17 days of early voting where you can walk in if you haven't registered and register and vote at the same time. So that's something that North Carolina offers. It's a great process. I just moved here 20 days ago, and the first thing I usually think about is registering to vote. Yeah, not really. Most people think about getting their driver's license. How do I get the kids to school? And then they think about voting when it comes up. So this is an excellent opportunity for somebody to get out and go ahead, register to vote, take care of all that. Or if you, well, you know, I moved last year, but I didn't change my address. Now, early vote is an excellent opportunity for you to go to one site, make that change and get the correct ballot that you will be voting on in your area so that you do not have to go from precinct to precinct on election day.
What if you're unsure about the accuracy of your registration? You can't remember whether you changed your address or maybe you're unsure about whether or not you were caught up in that dragnet of people that they're asking to re-register. What if you don't know? Is there an easy way to check?
A couple of easy ways. You can go on our website, MECKBOE, and check your registration. You can type in your name and your information. You can check to see if you're registered, where you're registered. There's also a link on our site to check to see if you're in that that list of registration repair individuals who had not given us a four-digit social or a driver's license. On their forms, they can check that and see if they can go ahead and correct that now. Most people had already received a letter from the North Carolina State Board of Elections that said, you need to do this. And a lot of people have responded to that for us. So we're good, but go ahead and check now. I think it's a great idea because if you are a change of address, you're going to know where you need to be.
So this registration repair project started, I think, in mid-August. They sent letters to about 82,000 voters, registered voters in North Carolina, who had not yet provided that information, like their driver's license number and or the last four digits of their social. We've already had a fall primary election in this area. Did that proved to be a problem, these 82,000 people? Did you have to turn anybody away in the primary?
No, that's the good thing about it. We're not going to turn you away. If you're on that list, you're in what they call an inactive status. And if you're in an inactive status, you're still registered, but we need to update your information, like get your driver's license number, like get your last four digits of your social, so we can verify and authenticate your registration. I think we had a smaller election, but I think we had about 50 or 60 in the primary election that were able to do that and correct their registration. Remember too, these are the elections where the voter, the one who votes all the time, is going to come out. These are the municipal elections are the ones that they'll make sure they hit. They'll hit those. So we don't expect a big issue here. I'm more concerned about next year where you have that casual voter that will come out.
So, Steve, Mecklenburg County voters will be going beginning today to the polls to vote on the 1% sales tax for transit referendum and for candidates for school board. Charlotte voters will also have city council elections and the election for mayor. So do you see any upsets or any surprises in the offing outside of this open contest in District 6 with Kimberly Owens and Krista Bakari?
In terms of the city of Charlotte, I think the short answer is no. I mean, like you said, the District 6 race is very competitive. It's a very evenly divided district between Democrats and Republicans. That will be close. Many of the other candidates are running unopposed because they won in the primary. In the at-large races for Charlotte City Council, there are two Republicans, including Edwin Peacock, who currently serves and served for a long time last decade. There are four seats, you know, so he's trying to get one of the four, but the numbers in the city of Charlotte are really daunting for a Republican to win citywide. The Republican registrants are down to under 20%.
And Susan, there are very few. There's only one really competitive race at the moment. Even the at-large races are populated mostly by incumbents, and the incumbents always, in every race, have the advantage, it seems to me. But what is the impact of so many races being non-competitive?
Well, I think one of the things, I call it sometimes, I think it's AT&T or consumer cellular, friends and family. And I think one of the things that you do get is, you know, the question of turnout and the razor thin margins and the fact that, is this a full throated endorsement? And when you turn out, you've got to either be the ideal voter, is this turnout voter in the municipal elections. They're motivated, they're smart, they know where to find their polling place, and they're partisan. And I think they'll turn out regardless of how competitive one or two races are. I'm curious about, with the 1% sales tax, is the shutdown going to divert attention away from that? Or is it going to encourage people to say, I'm going to get up and vote because I don't want my money going anywhere else. So I don't know whether it could depress turnout. I have no idea.
We're talking about the upcoming elections. And they're not upcoming anymore. They're here. Early voting began today throughout Mecklenburg County. And we're talking about that this morning. And we'll talk about election security as well on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. In these last two election cycles, Steve, during which the former occupant of the District 6 City Council seat in Charlotte was held by Republican Tariq Bakari, he narrowly won against his challenger in both those elections. It was the same person, Stephanie Hand. I think it was by 347 votes one time, 314 votes, give or take, the other time. Now there is no incumbent. However, Krista Bakari shares his last name because she's his wife, and she's running against a Democrat, Kimberly Owens. That seat has been in Republican hands for 20 years. But given the closeness of the previous two cycles, is the tide changing, or was that more about people being unhappy with Tariq Bakari?
It could be a little bit of both. I think the tide is definitely changing in terms of voter demographics in South Charlotte. That used to be 20 years ago, a very, very Republican area. And just as we've seen these changes in all American cities, where people who live in cities, whether they're Republicans or Democrat, have shifted to the left. And we've seen that also in Charlotte District 6. So Democrats locally feel that it's only a matter of time before they flip that seat. Whether it happens in 2025, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But again, a big change just in terms of how these voters vote locally and at the presidential level.
And I only have about 30 seconds left, but Edwin Peacock's name has been bandied about, and he's been on council before. He's on council now, temporarily filling that District 6 seat. He's running at large against all these incumbents. Does he have a shot, do you think?
Like I said earlier, it's going to be tough just because the percent of registered Republicans in the city is now below 20%. The math makes it really challenging.
Talking about election, early voting in elections today, and we'll be talking about election security as we go through the program this hour with Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics reporter, Susan Roberts, political science professor at Davidson College, and Michael Dickerson, director of the Mecklenburg Board of Elections. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about elections, the off-year elections are going on right now. Early voting began today in Mecklenburg County. We're here with Steve Harrison, our politics reporter on WFAE. Susan Roberts is a professor of political science at Davidson College, and Michael Dickerson is director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. We're usually pretty Charlotte-centric when it comes to all of this, but the Charlotte races are really in stasis, Steve. That is not necessarily the case in the various races going on in towns around Charlotte. So what's happening in those other Mecklenburg towns?
Yeah, all six Mecklenburg towns have municipal races this fall. They're different from Charlotte in that they are nonpartisan, so they did not have primaries back in the fall. But yeah, there are a lot of interesting contests. In Huntersville, 2 years ago, Democrats made the Mecklenburg Democratic Party made a big push. They swept the board, even though it's officially nonpartisan. Many people do know which political party each candidate is aligned with. Mayor Christy Clark is running against former commissioner Derek Partee, who lost to her 2 years ago. And then you go up to Cornelius Woody Washam. He defeated Dennis Bilodeau by just 5 votes 2 years ago. There's a rematch there. Matthews will have all six commissioners are on the ballot. At least 3 are going to be new. So yes, there is really, like you said, Mike, kind of the action is outside of the city of Charlotte.
And you mentioned that last election cycle in Huntersville, Democrats swept all of the seats on the Huntersville Town Council. Was that a fluke? Is that an indication that the politics of that area is changing? Are they likely to be able to maintain that this time? Do we have any indication of that at all?
It was definitely partially an indication that the politics of the area are changing just as it becomes, closer to the city, more urban. Those voters just tend to vote for Democrats. But also the county party made this big push in Huntersville to try and flip the town council. They really spent a lot of money and effort. They printed out their blue ballot and had it out at all the polls and early voting sites. So we'll see whether that was a one-time thing or whether Republicans can kind of claw back in what has traditionally been a very Republican-friendly town.
And in Charlotte, of course, Vi Lyles, unless something amazing happens, has a headlock on the job of mayor, I think, for as long as she wants it, or at least in this election cycle. That is not the case, as you mentioned, in Cornelius, where Mayor Woody Washam edged challenger Dennis Bilodeau by just 5 votes 2 years ago, and they're head-to-head again this time. Any indication of who seems to have the edge? There must be, if you're going to lose by 5 votes, you might as well run again to see if you can win it this time around, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, just go and get your neighbors to make sure they vote for you. I mean, could be the difference. No, that's a tough call to say who has the edge in such a close race. There's also a third candidate on the ballot, Kenny Campbell as well.
And in Matthews, everything, as you pointed out, is up for grabs. All the seats on the commission and the office of mayor. Current Mayor John Higdon is unaffiliated, but this is a nonpartisan race. They don't necessarily put the D and the R after their name on the ballots, but he faces a Republican challenger. And some say the outcome of these races could serve as some kind of a preview of Democratic competitiveness at the state legislature level next year. Do you agree with that?
I think one of the things that will be interesting to watch in Matthews is, in a way, is the transit tax vote, because, as you know, we've talked about many times, Matthews is very, very upset about being left out, not having the Silver Line brought to their town. In the state house race next year, Republican Tricia Cotham was the main sponsor of the bill. She will be running against a Matthews commissioner, Ken McCool, and it will be interesting to see if there's a lot of weak support for the transit tax in Matthews, that you could kind of take that vote and perhaps forecast it in terms of Cotham's reelection chances in her district, which is Mint Hill, Matthews, and part of South Charlotte.
So, Susan, all of the races around around Charlotte are nonpartisan. Charlotte is one of the few cities in North Carolina in which the people running for council and mayor are either Republicans or Democrats or independents and have to identify themselves as such. First of all, why? Why us? Why, why are we one of the few cities that are partisan? And is that a positive or is it a negative?
Well, there were a couple of things that I decided I was not going to talk about. And one is whether or not nonpartisan elections are a facade. I mean, everyone up here knows who is a Democrat or Republican. It's a small town, and you kind of know who's running what and who's a good Democrat or a good Republican. And I think that that's something that, you know, if we're the kind of quote unquote good government kind of area up here, I think I would rather have be upfront about it. Is somebody a Democrat or Republican? It doesn't, in Davidson at least, it doesn't lend a lot of nuance. You pretty much know who's going to win. You may know, you may suspect their partisanship, but I think it's something that perhaps, well, partisanship either veiled or pronounced. I mean, I think it's going to creep into these. I think it's maybe a facade that they're nonpartisan.
We are, as you well know, incredibly divided. If you're a Democrat, there's no such thing as a good Republican. And if you're a Republican, there is no such thing as a good Democrat anymore. And it doesn't seem to be, the two parties don't seem to be able to have intelligent, non-passionate conversations to get things done. And there seems to be no desire. That's certainly true in Washington. It's certainly true in Raleigh. Is it true at the municipal level?
Well, can I just jump in about the national level?
Sure.
We had an event, this Institute for Public Good, and they invited Tom Tillis and Amy Klobuchar to talk about deliberative good citizenship. And, you know, there was a real bipartisan thrust. I mean, there was no red meat. And I think they talked about democracy. And I was pleasantly satisfied with the discussion that stayed on topic about democracy and how to accomplish perhaps more bipartisanship. And that's just one incident. So I think that, you know, that is something to consider, that there is some bipartisanship. And in some of my textbooks on Congress and the presidency, for a number of years, the index didn't have anything about bipartisanship, not a word. You couldn't find it in the index. So I think it's more recent. But I think there is everybody saying turn down the temperature. And whether that's possible or not, I don't know.
Steve.
Yeah, I was thinking about your question, Mike. And I think the most interesting case of that this year is the transit tax referendum. Because if you kind of go by history, Republicans would be opposed to it because it's a big sales tax increase. They might be skeptical of spending so much on mass transit. But it's kind of wacky this time is that it's it was a Republican bill. A lot of the support comes from Republicans, and all of the vocal opposition has come from the left. So, at these local races, the category of Democrat, Republican next to your name doesn't really always translate into the skirmishes we see in Washington. And in fact, on this transit tax, it's totally, in a way, arguably, the roles have been reversed.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I think, is because of the regressive nature of sales taxes, clearly. But it's also a kind of a microcosm of what we see happening throughout the country, where moneyed interests seem to rule the day, sometimes at the expense of those of us who don't have that money. And that is the case here, because this is a development project as much as it is a transportation project, and there's money to be made. Michael, none of this matters. None of these elections matter at all if we cannot trust the integrity of our elections. That's the integrity of American elections has never been called into question. until recent years. We've taken it for granted. Maybe we shouldn't have, but there's no indication that our elections have been anything but on the up and up. But suddenly there are many allegations and suspicions swirling around how our elections are conducted and conspiracy theories, more than you can shake a stick at about how our elections are rigged, particularly if your side loses. How do you explain this? You've been doing this a long time.
It is something, you're right. It is something that has recently crept up, but people have always talked about it in the past. Is it safe? The other side's cheating or somebody's doing this. So I've always understood that's an issue. What I don't think people realize is the amount of effort that actually goes into producing this election. The amount of testing, the amount of programming, the amount of training of all of these workers. There are 2,000-3,000 workers that we'll use on election day and during early voting that have to be trained, have to be secured, have to know the process. They're not all from one party. They're Democrats. They're Republicans. They're unaffiliated individuals who are just out there to make sure that you may vote and your vote will be protected and it will be secured.
Can the same be said of every election district in the state and around the country?
I believe it can be by the state. And I think the vast majority of these around the country are all doing a great job. I can't speak to them. But you know how it is. Somebody's going to say something that's going to be taken out of text. I always get questions about they're mailing out ballots in Arizona. We don't need to do that. Well, we don't do that. You have to request your absentee ballot. People will get something on the national level and think it affects us here.
And
it may be something.
Is that part of the problem, that people don't understand the process and how it works, and they don't understand that every state is in control of even the national elections? Mm-hmm. They make up the rules about how things are done. And even district by district, the rules can differ because some districts have paper ballots, others have machine ballots, etc. Is that part of the confusion?
That's exactly it. You've hit it right, the nail right on the head. Somebody thinks that there's a master switch that we can throw and it'll change the election throughout the country. That's not the case. Each one of us here in North Carolina, each county runs their own election. We all answer to the state. The state runs the election through us, and each of us perform and make sure that the election is run smoothly under the guise of what the state is telling us to do. That's the hard part about it. People will hear something that went on somewhere else and they think it's happening here.
So in March, Donald Trump issued an executive order called Preserving and Protecting the Integrity of American Elections. It is in effect and it is being implemented despite some legal hurdles, but it requires proof of citizenship for voter registration, voting equipment standards, among other things. Is our state requiring proof of citizenship for those registering to vote here? If you didn't have to do that when you registered, are you still validly registered under this new executive order? And have we had to make any changes to voting equipment to be in compliance with this?
Not here in North Carolina. We have always required that you complete a document that says you are a citizen. We require the identification process.
But will that be sufficient if Republicans decide to challenge the validity of your registration? If you've just said you're a citizen, you could be anybody.
Correct. That's understood. But at the same time, you have to give me some other identifying information that will help us identify you. I think you've looked at studies done around the country by the groups like the Brennan Center and various organizations like that say, you know, what is voter fraud? How many cases of voter fraud have we actually had over the past 20 years? It's minuscule.
Yeah.
But it's something that we appreciate that because we check that before it goes out.
And part of the reason for this are all these accusations that non-citizens, immigrants, are voting in our elections. And that's being promulgated by a lot of people on the right and by Donald Trump. Non-citizens should not be allowed to vote in our elections. Susan, do we know if that happens to any notable degree, which would make this provision necessary? And do you believe that complying with proof of citizenship actually targets some groups who would find it difficult to produce that proof?
Well, I think as Michael points out, there is there's voter fraud, but it shouldn't be confused with election fraud. Sometimes, you know, errors happen and the equipment is something else, but it is very difficult to prove much voter fraud. I think it might be more difficult for some individuals. And I think we've seen most unfortunately, in some ICE raids and these kind of things, racial profiling. And I would hate to see that as something that would make some people on edge, because it's very easy to make people feel uncomfortable about voting. And, you know, you put up a billboard, as has been the case, that, you know, if you go, they're going to check your, you know, your election records, your criminal records. And I think that has a depressing, it depresses turnout.
Early voting began today, and that's why we're talking all about this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Michael, you've been involved in running elections for a quarter century and only recently found the need to defend what it is that you and others like you do. And this is happening around the country. It's you're being attacked mostly by people on the right. If our elections are rigged, why aren't those on the left equally loud?
Well, it starts with the if part of that question. It's not rigged. It is our end of it is purely, it's functioning exactly how it's supposed to do. People don't realize the amount of testing that we actually do on each piece of equipment, the checking, the verification, and that training. If you ask a poll worker, is it rigged? Obviously, they're gonna say, I don't understand how you can rig it. The neat thing about our election process here in North Carolina is that none of it can be on the internet. There is no connectivity of any of this data. I don't have modems. I don't have Ethernet lines in any of these computers. For God's sakes, I can't even download the results from each site on a computer that's hooked up to the internet. I literally have to do it to a standalone computer, walk a thumb drive, a brand new out of the package thumb drive, over to a computer that's on the internet before I can put it in. So it's, again, you hear things, oh, well, they did this in Idaho or something. Well, it doesn't happen that way in North Carolina.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this and what the decentralization of our election system means for election integrity. That seems to be make it better, although there are some moves to want to have it nationalized in some way, which would make it worse because it make it easier to break into. We'll talk about that and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Early voting began today. It runs through November the 1st, and then the election day, I think, is the 4th of November in these off-year elections, and we're talking about that and election integrity with Steve Harrison, our politics reporter at WFAE News, Susan Roberts is a professor of political science at Davidson College, and Michael Dickerson's with us. He's the director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. Steve, there have been very few incidences of election fraud, even voter fraud, and outside of what we experienced a couple of years ago with voter fraud in the 9th Congressional District in North Carolina. Have elections in the state been relatively free from tampering or even accusations of fraud?
Yeah, I think most definitely. And part of that is because President Trump has won North Carolina 3 straight times, right? So he's 3 for 3. And he credits, you know, the State Republican Party and the RNC for in his words, you know, ensuring there was no fraud. So when the president wins, everything is good. And I guess going back a little bit, you mentioned the Ninth District, the mail ballot scandal from 2018. I think a lot of the talk nationally about election security has been around mail voting, the increase of mail voting. And then because of that scandal here in North Carolina, the state has some pretty restrictive rules on mail ballots and what you need to do to get them, who can touch them once you receive it. And so we've been kind of off the radar in terms of that national debate over mail voting. And a large part of that is going back 7 years ago.
Yeah, there's some interesting things going on. There are a lot of people on the MAGA right who don't believe in vaccinations, and yet the president just got a COVID shot. Donald Trump also votes by mail and insists that voting by mail is rigged and cannot be trusted. So, Michael, what's your counter to that?
I think voting by mail is an extremely safe process and efficient process for especially a lot of people who cannot get out and vote. So I encourage it. It is, as Steve was saying, we've got two witness signatures that you have to provide on an absentee ballot request. You even still have to show a photo ID when you vote by mail. You literally have to make a photocopy of your driver's license and send me a copy of that with it, or a reasonable impediment form that says I can't make an ID copy because of this reason. Here again, after that gets done, we have a board, a bipartisan board here in the office that actually reviews and checks these and submits them for approval.
So, Susan, American elections are decentralized. They are not controlled by the federal government, even during presidential cycles. The states control the elections in each state. Each state has its own set of rules and processes. One argument in favor of that is that it makes it very difficult for bad actors to influence the outcome of our elections, because they'd have to do it in every precinct in the country, and there must be thousands of them. How do you see it?
I think the decentralization is positive. It has been so far. But I think at least in these elections, if there's a close margin, people might anecdotally get an idea that something's rigged. And I think the website, MECBOE, is very good. It's very accessible. It gives you ideas. But if you lay on here in North Carolina, for example, it's been over a 10-year and Steve can address this and Michael better than I, a 10-year ping pong about photo ID. And so people get confused about that. If you lay on their redistricting, people get confused about that. Voters may seek information, but that's built into our system in North Carolina.
Let me ask you very quickly, Michael, because I want to get a lot of questions asked in the next few minutes that we don't have time to get in. But voter ID was positioned by some as being an impediment to voting for a lot of people. Did it prove to be the case? And are there other things in the pipeline that people are suggesting we do that might be impediments to voting?
Keep in mind, voter ID has, over the past 10 years, has gone through different iterations here in North Carolina. And that's the most important thing to think about. It's working with both sides to figure out what is a solution. Now, if you don't have an ID, you may still vote, but you have to give me a reason, we call a reasonable impediment, why you do not have that ID. And if they can come up with
that.
How many
people have been turned away because they didn't have a voter ID?
Very few in my county. Very few have been turned away. That doesn't say how many people did not go because they were fearful of not having the correct ID. But we've got it figured out here.
Steve?
I was just going to say that I can't remember the numbers, but in this upcoming election next month, it's going to be the number of people who have to fill out the impediment form is going to be a couple hundred probably. And I think the vast majority of those will end up counting. I think the next kind of fight, and I don't really see it happening. Once the impediment form was put into use for the first time, there were some Republicans in Raleigh who felt like it was too easy to vote without an ID, because you can fill out the form and say, I lost it. That allows you to vote. And they kind of felt like, well, it was a bit of a toothless thing, but we haven't heard any talk about them changing that this year. And so I don't think that's going to change. Slightly more Democrats have been impacted by the lack of photo ID than Republicans. But again, it's a very, very small number to start with.
A lot of the attacks on our election process in recent years, Michael, have fallen on the people at the polls, the poll workers, who are your next door neighbors. They are people who go to your church, who have kids in your kids' school, etc. They're ordinary citizens like the rest of us. But elections officials are, in fact, trained. And the North Carolina Board of Elections offers training to county elections directors and staff and to members of county boards of election. And the Bipartisan Policy Center conducted a study on how states conduct training. And North Carolina is a case study for all of this. Should that give voters confidence?
Oh, I think so. Yes, they should feel very comfortable that we've changed administrations at the state level as far as going from a three-member Democratic board to a three-member Republican board. And they are encouraging the same stuff, the same, let's train everybody. Let's make sure we're doing this accurately. They're going to go about things differently, but their goal is to make sure that they give the best election to North Carolinians.
And let me ask you very quickly. What does the training consist of?
Our local training is for us as members of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections and the State Board. We go to various conferences throughout the year. We have every other week, we usually have an election connection where we're discussing what we have to do. And then they also throw out there all the policies that we have to follow. Here's our new state board memo on how you're going to handle registration repair or what you do with provisionals in the 2026 election. They stay on top of it, and they're keeping us informed.
The suspicion on the part of a lot of people about people working at elections who really want one candidate or the other to win. And you told Charlotte Magazine, Michael, you don't care who wins or loses, and that you just want the one who wins to be the one who gets the most votes, and that's what you do. But everybody cares. Come on. Everybody cares who wins or loses. No one is truly nonpartisan. So in this deeply divided country of ours, how can that be, and how do you convince voters that your thumb is not on the scale?
My job is to make sure that everybody can vote. My job is to count the votes. My job's not to select a winner. My job is to count, and my job is to make sure everything's done the way it's supposed to do. And I can separate my professional career from any personal belief I have. So I'm not worried about that. And I expect that's what my staff everybody that is associated with this will do.
And Susan, you have to give people the benefit of the doubt. And we used to do that because we believed that we had people of integrity in our government. We had people of integrity running our elections. We had people of integrity in our medical establishment, in our educational establishments. We don't believe that anymore. People don't believe that anymore. How did we get here? And can we continue to function if we don't have that common shared belief?
Well, and just along the lines of what Michael was saying, logistics have become political, and they've become political because of the outcomes in question. But some of the goals in the Bipartisan Policy Center, it's ambiguous enough, but they want to bring that trust, not just transparency or accessibility, but I think the hostility, the rhetoric, and the chaos, I've quoted this to my students many times in The Atlantic. A quote was, Trump didn't cause the chaos. The chaos caused Trump. So there are things in there in terms of the changing demographics of the electorate, many things that will still be there after, President Trump is no longer in office.
And the people, in many cases, raising suspicions about our elections seem to be the same who are trying to restrict votes. But who votes, either by curtailing voting locations and hours or disqualifying people because there might be some inaccuracy in their registration, or by drawing districts so that only one party can win. Could it be said that it is the people who are pushing for those things, the one who they're the ones that we must worry about when it comes to ensuring that the candidates voters most want to win actually have a shot at winning?
Well, if you're stating that our goal is to ensure to draw more Republican districts in North Carolina, there couldn't be anything more blatantly political than that. And Governor Newsom saying, well, we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to do it through, a referendum. I think it's when you start to look at that, it's blatantly political. And I think people do have fears. I mean, I think, let me just give you one thing that's kind of, if I were to say to you, there could be questions, and Michael, you can just say, Susan, you're crazy, of cybersecurity at the local level. When I'm teaching campaign strategy, it's more at the local level or the state level that people use deep fakes because there's no accountability. And one more thing with Michael, as pundits, we get on election night because where are those results from Mecklenburg County? Where are those results? And I think it's good that they're late. That means somebody's doing their job.
So let's talk about this very quickly because it cannot be stressed enough. We've done a lot of shows on election security and voting machine security. And you mentioned this earlier in the program, Michael, but some people didn't hear it. So I want you to repeat it again. Can you tell me unequivocally that our election system in Mecklenburg County and throughout North Carolina is fair and accurate? And how do you know that? How do you know the machines have been programmed properly and that the tabulators are programmed properly?
I can unequivocally say that they are. All my colleagues throughout the state, I believe, are just as passionate about making sure they get this done. Look, none of us in our business want you to be talking about us a week after the election. We want it done with. We have spent the last few weeks, months, are getting ready for it. But every one of these, each one of us programs our own equipment. Each one of us tests our own equipment. Each one of us hold these away from the internet and no way to attack it.
How do we know, excuse me, but how do we know that the manufacturers of this equipment, for instance, the Dominion voting equipment, which we do not use here, but right. that's been bought by another company, which is now being run by a Republican elections operative. They've renamed Dominion Liberty. How do we know that there's not some sleeper code in the computer that activates only at 7:30 when the polls close on election night and disappears at midnight when the votes have been tallied to change the outcome of the vote? How do we know that?
I know it in our office by actual personal process. We have had to recount the last two elections. We've had to recount the races in the last two elections. This last election, we had a recount in one district. I think it was District 5, if I'm not mistaken. The votes from a hand-counted ballot to what was produced on the machine were identical. In 2024, we recounted the entire Griffin-Beasley race here in our county. Over 580,000 votes were counted. We were off by four. And so I can, in good confidence, say that what you slid into the machine to tally was exactly what you voted for. The other thing is, too, our state requires and demands us to, they'll select random precincts immediately after the election. And Michael, go count these precincts to see if the numbers show the same as what was reported. That's a sort of a verification after the fact, not to mention all we do before the fact.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And does that happen in every precinct and in every state around the country?
I assume every state, everybody wants to be as good as North Carolina. when they do their elections. I know in every county here in North Carolina, we have to do that.
Susan, when you look at how our political campaigns are conducted and financed, at the impact of Citizens United on our election outcomes, at the primary system, which was supposed to take the choice of candidates away from the smoke-filled rooms and give it to the people, and when you add in the impact of gerrymandering, what is the result of all this on the outcomes of our elections, on voter confidence and satisfaction, and on voter turnout?
Well, I used to have campaign finance as my number one concern. That's no longer the case. It's gerrymandering. And I think that has an influence on everything. And your vote, you don't feel your vote counts, even if you're counting it correctly.
Get out and vote. Early voting began today. More locations open up as the early voting period stretches on through November the 1st. And Election Day is November the 4th. And we do have a big decision to make about transit on the ballot here in Mecklenburg County. And your voice needs to be heard on that. Thanks to Susan Roberts, the last voice you heard from Davidson College. Michael Dickerson is director of the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections, and Steve Harrison with us. He's our politics reporter at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.